Side 6, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 188. The Rendors, shrieking war cries and religious slogans, came scrambling up the rude ladders, only to fall howling and writhing from those ladders, as great waves of scalding pitch engulfed them, burning, searing. "Torches!" Sparhawk commanded. Half a hundred flaming torches sailed out over the walls to ignite the pools of liquid pitch and naphtha below. A great sheet of flame shot up to bathe the walls and to burn those Rendors still clinging to their ladders as ants sizzle, shrivel, and fall from a log cast into a fire. Burning men ran from the crowd below, shrieking, stumbling blindly, and trailing streams of dripping flame like comets as they ran. Still the Rendors came. And still the scaling ladders ponderously rose from their ranks, pushed from the rear by hundreds of hands to swing up and up, then to hesitate, standing vertically, and then to fall slowly against the wall. Fanatics, wild-eyed, and some actually foaming at the mouth, were desperately climbing even before the ladders fell into place. From the top of the walls the defenders pushed the ladders away with long poles, and the ladders reversed their rise, teetered back out to stand momentarily motionless, and then toppled backward, carrying the men near their tops to their deaths below. Hundreds of Rendors crowded near the base of the walls to avoid the arrows from above, and they dashed out to scramble up the ladders toward the tops of the walls. "Lead!" Sparhawk commanded then. The lead had been Bavier's idea. Each sarcophagus in the crypt beneath the basilica had been surmounted by a leaden effigy of its inhabitant. The sarcophagi were now unadorned, and the effigies had been melted down. Bubbling cauldrons stood at intervals along the tops of the walls, and at Sparhawk's command they were pushed forward and overturned to pour down in great silvery sheets on the Rendors clustered at the base of the wall. The shrieks this time did not last for long, and no man ran blazing from the attack after he had been entombed in liquid lead. Some few, then more, did reach the tops of the walls. The church soldiers met them with a bravery born of desperation, and they held the fanatics long enough to permit the knights to come to their aid. Sparhawk strode forward at the head of the phalanx of black-armored pandions. He swung his heavy broadsword steadily, rhythmically. The broadsword is not a weapon with much finesse, and the big pandion knight did not so much fight his way through the shrieking Rendors as he did chop open a wide path. His sword was an instrument of dismemberment, and hands and whole arms flew spinning from his strokes to rain down on the faces of attackers still on the scaling ladders. Heads went sailing out to fall either on the outside of the wall or on the inside, depending on the direction of Sparhawk's swing. The knights following him and disposing of the wounded were soon wading in blood. One Rendor, quite skinny and waving a rusty saber, stood howling before the man in black armor bearing down on him. Sparhawk altered his swing slightly and sheared the man almost in two at the waist. The Rendor was hurled against the battlements by the force of the blow, and the remaining shred of flesh ripped as the upper torso toppled outward. The man's lower half caught up on one of the battlements, the legs threshing wildly. The Rendor's upper torso did not quite reach the ground below, but hung head downward from a long rope of purple bowel that steamed in the cool night air. The torso swung slowly back and forth, jerking slightly downward as its intestines gradually unraveled. "Sparhawk," Galton shouted as Sparhawk's arm began to grow weary. "Get your breath. I'll take over here." And so it went until the top of the wall was once again secure, and all the scaling ladders had been shoved away. The Rendors milled around below, still falling victim to arrows and to large rocks thrown down on them from the walls. And then they broke and fled. Colton came back, panting and wiping his sword. "Good fight," he said, grinning. "Tolerable," Sparhawk agreed laconically. "Rendors aren't very good fighters, though." "Those are the best kind to face," Colton laughed. He pulled back one foot to kick the bottom half of the skinny Rendor off the wall. "Leave him where he is," Sparhawk said shortly. "Let's give the next wave of attackers something to look at while they're crossing the field to get here. You might as well tell the people cleaning up down on the inside of the wall to save any loose heads they come across as well. We'll set them on stakes along the battlements." "Object lessons again?" "Why not? A man who's attacking a defended wall is entitled to know what's likely to happen to him, wouldn't you say? Bavier came hurrying down the bloody parapet. Hewlett's been hurt, he shouted to them from several yards away. He turned to lead them back to their injured friend, and the church soldiers melted out of his way. Perhaps unconsciously, Bavier was still brandishing his Lochaber axe. Hewlett lay on his back. His eyes were rolled back in his head, and blood was running out of his ears. What happened? Sparhawk demanded of Tinian. Arendor ran up behind him and hit him on the head with an axe. Sparhawk's heart sank. Tinian gently removed Euleth's horned helmet and gingerly probed through the Genidian knight's blonde hair. I don't think his head's broken, he reported. Maybe the Rendor didn't swing hard enough, Calton surmised. I saw the blow. The Rendor swung as hard as he could. That blow should have split Euleth's head like a melon. Tinian frowned, tapping on the bulging knot of horn that joined the two curling points jutting from each side of their friend's conical helmet. Then he examined the helmet closely. Not a scratch, he marveled. He took out his dagger and scraped at the horn, but was unable even to mar its shiny surface. Then, finally overcome by curiosity, he picked up Euleth's fallen war axe and hacked at the horn several times without even chipping it. That's amazing, he said. That's the hardest stuff I've ever come across. That's probably why Euleth's still got his brains inside his head, Calton said. He doesn't look too good, though. Let's carry him to Sophrania. You three go on ahead, Sparhawk told them regretfully. I've got to go talk with Vanion. The four preceptors stood together some distance away where they had been observing the attack. Sir Euleth's been hurt, my lord, Sparhawk reported to Comier. Is it bad? Vanion asked quickly. There's no such thing as a good injury, Vanion, Comier said. What happened, Sparhawk? Arendor hit him in the head with an axe, my lord. In the head, you say? He'll be all right, then. He reached up and wrapped his knuckles on his own ogre-horned helmet. That's why we wear these. He didn't look very good, Sparhawk said gravely. Tinian, Calton, and Bavier are taking him to Sophrania. He'll be all right, Comier insisted. Sparhawk pushed Euleth's injury to the back of his mind. I think I've put my finger on some of Martell's strategy, my lords. He saddled himself with those Rendors for a specific reason. Rendors aren't really very good at modern warfare. They don't wear any kind of protective armor, not even helmets, and they're pitifully incapable of any form of swordsmanship. We swept them off the top of that wall the way you'd mow a hayfield. All they really have is a raging fanaticism, and they'll attack in the face of insurmountable odds. Martell's going to keep throwing them at us to wear us down and to reduce our numbers. Then, after he's weakened and exhausted us, he'll throw in his Camorian and Lamarck mercenaries. We've got to work out some way to keep those Rendors off the walls. I'm going to go talk with Curic. Maybe he can come up with a few ideas. Curic, as a matter of fact, could. His years of experience and the reminiscences of grizzled old veterans he had met from time to time provided him with a large number of very nasty ideas. They were objects he called caltrops, fairly simple, four-pronged steel things that could be made in such a way that no matter how far they were thrown, they would always land with one sharp-pointed steel prong pointing upward. Rendors did not wear boots, but only soft leather sandals. A generous smearing of poison on the pointed prongs made the caltrops lethal as opposed to merely inconvenient. 10-foot-long beams with sharpened stakes attached to them to protrude like the spines of a hedgehog and once again doctored with poison provided fairly insurmountable barriers when rolled down long beams to lie in profusion out in front of the walls. Long log pendulums swinging from the battlements parallel to the walls would sweep scaling ladders away like cobwebs. None of these will actually hold off really serious attacks, Sparhawk, Curic said, but they'll slow people down to the point where crossbowmen and regular archers can pick them off. Not very many attackers will reach the walls. That's sort of what we had in mind, Sparhawk said. Let's commandeer the citizenry and put them to work on these ideas. All that the people of Kyrelos are doing right now is sitting around eating. Let's give them a chance to earn their keep. The construction of Curic's obstacles took several days, and there were several more renderish attacks in the interim. Then Preceptor Abriel's catapults scattered the caltrops in profusion in front of the walls, and the hedgehogs rolled down long beams to lie in tangles and clusters some 20 yards or so out from the walls. After that, very few rendors reached the walls, and the ones who did were not encumbered by scaling ladders. They would normally mill around, shouting slogans and hacking at the walls with their swords until the bowmen on top of the walls had the leisure to kill them. After a few of those abortive attacks, Martell pulled back for a day or so to reconsider his strategy. It was still summer, however, and the hordes of dead Rendors lying outside the walls began to bloat in the sun. The smell of rotting flesh made the inner city distinctly unpleasant. One evening, Sparhawk and his companions took advantage of the lull to return to the chapter house for much-needed baths and a hot meal. Before they did anything else, however, they stopped by to visit Sir Euleth. The big Genidian knight lay in his bed. His eyes were still unfocused, and he had a confused look on his face.
"I'm getting tired of just lying around, brothers," he said in a slurred voice. "And it's hot in here. Why don't we go out and hunt down a troll? Slogging through the snow should cool off our blood a little."
"He thinks he's in the Genidian mother house at Hade," Sophronia told the knights quietly. "He keeps wanting to go troll hunting. He thinks I'm a serving wench, and he's been making all sorts of improper suggestions to me."
Bavier gasped.
"And then sometimes he cries," she added.
"Euleth?"
Finian said in some amazement. "It may be a subterfuge, though. The first time he did it, I tried to comfort him, and it turned into a sort of wrestling match. He's very strong, considering his condition."
"Will he be all right?" Calton asked. "I mean, will he regain his senses?"
"It's very hard to say, Calton. That blow bruised his brain, I think, and you never know how something like that's going to turn out. I think you'd better leave, dear ones. Don't excite him."
Euleth began to make a long, rambling speech in the language of the trolls, and Sparhawk was surprised to discover that he still understood the language. The spell Sophronia had cast in Gwerig's cave seemed to still have some of its potency left. After he had bathed and shaved, Sparhawk put on a monk's robe and joined the others in the nearly deserted refectory, where their meal was laid on a long table.
"What's Martell going to do next?"
Preceptor Comier was asking Abriel.
"He'll probably fall back on fairly standard siege tactics," Abriel replied. "Most likely he'll settle down and let his siege engines pound us for a while. Those fanatics were just about his only chance for a quick victory. This may drag out for quite some time." They all sat quietly, listening to the monotonous crash of large rocks falling into the city around them. Then Talon burst into the room. His face was smudged, and his clothes were dirty.
"I just saw Martell, my lords," he said excitedly.
"We've all seen him, Talon," Calton said, sprawling deeper into his chair. "He rides up outside the walls now and then to have a look around."
"He wasn't outside the walls, Calton," Talon said. "He was in the cellar under the basilica."
"What are you saying, boy?" Dolmet demanded.
Talon drew in a deep breath.
I wasn't entirely honest with you gentlemen when I told you how I was getting the thieves of Kyrelos out of the inner city," he confessed.
He held up one hand.
"I did arrange for a meeting between the thieves and those church soldiers on the wall with their rope. That part was completely true. About the only thing I didn't tell you was that I found another way as well. I just didn't want to bore you with a lot of extra details. Anyway, not long after we got here, I happened to be down in the lowest cellar under the basilica, and I found a passageway. I don't know what it was used for originally, but it leads off to the north. It's perfectly round, and the stones of the walls and floor are very smooth. I followed it, and it took me out into the city."
"Does it show any signs of being used as a passageway at all?"
Patriarch Emban asked.
"Not when I went through it the first time, no, Your Grace. The cobwebs were as thick as ropes."
"Oh, that thing," Sir Noshan said. "I've heard about it, but I never got around to investigating it. The old torture chambers are down in that cellar. It's the sort of place most people want to avoid."
"The passageway, Noshan," Vanion said to him. "What's it for?"
"It's an old aqueduct, my lord. It was part of the original construction of the basilica. It runs north to the river Kaidu to carry water to the inner city. Everybody tells me that it collapsed centuries ago,
Not all of it, Sir Knight, Talon told him. It runs far enough out into the main city to be useful. To make it short, I was looking around and I found this... What was it you called that passage?
An aqueduct, Noshin supplied.
That's a peculiar word. Anyway, I found it and I followed it. And it came out in the cellar of a warehouse, several streets on out in the city. It doesn't go any farther than that, though, but it doesn't really have to. There's a door leading out from the cellar into an alley. That's the information I was selling to the thieves of Kyrelos. Anyway, I was down in that cellar this afternoon, and I saw Martell come sneaking out of that passageway. I hid, and he went on by. He was alone, so I followed him, and he went into a kind of storeroom. Annius was waiting for him there. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but they had their heads very close together like men doing some very serious plotting. They talked together for a while, and then they left the storeroom. Martell told Annius to wait for the usual signal, and then to meet him again down there. He said, I'll want you someplace safe when the fighting starts. Then Annius said that he was still worried about the possibility of Worgen showing up. But Martell laughed and said, Don't worry about Worgen, my friend. He's blithely ignorant of everything that's happening here. Then they left. I waited a while and came right here. How did Martell find out about the aqueduct? Calden asked him. Some of his men probably chased one of the thieves and found it. Talon shrugged. Everybody gets civic-spirited when it comes to chasing thieves. I've been chased by absolute strangers sometimes.
That explains Worgen's absence, Comyr said bleakly. All our messengers have probably been ambushed.
And Alana's still sitting in Simera with only Strogan and Platymy to defend her, Sparhawk said in a worried tone. I think I'll go down to that cellar and wait for Martell. He'll come along eventually, and I can waylay him.
Absolutely not, Imban said sharply.
Your Grace, Sparhawk objected. I think you're overlooking the fact that if Martell dies, this siege dies with him.
And I think you're overlooking the fact that our real goal here is to defeat Annius in the election. I need a report of a conversation between Annius and Martell to swing the votes I need to beat the Primate of Simera. Our situation here is getting very tenuous, gentlemen. Every time those fires out there sweep into a new quarter, we lose a few more votes.
Wouldn't Talon's report of a meeting between Annius and Martell make the Hierocracy suspicious, Your Grace? Colton asked.
Most of the Hierocracy never heard of Martell, Sir Colton, Imban replied, and this boy is not the most reliable of witnesses. Somebody in Kyrelos is bound to know that he's a thief. We have to have a totally incorruptible and reliable witness, one whose neutrality and objectivity can never be questioned. The commander of the Archprelate's personal guard, perhaps? Ortzel suggested.
The very man, Imban agreed, snapping his fingers.
If we can get him down into the cellar where he can hear Martell and Annius talking, it might give me something to place before the Hierocracy.
Aren't you overlooking the fact that when Martell comes through that aqueduct he's going to have a small army with him, Your Grace? Vanion asked. He said something about wanting to get Annius to safety before the fighting starts. That sounds to me as if he plans to lead a surprise attack into the Basilica itself. Your witness won't find a very attentive audience if all the patriarchs are running for their lives.
Don't trouble me with these details, Vanion, Imban said airily. Just post some men down there.
Gladly, but where do I get the men?
Take some of those fellows down off the walls. They're not doing anything useful anyway.
Vanion's face turned very red, and a thick vein started to throb in his forehead.
You'd better let me tell him, Vanion, Comyr suggested. We don't want you to come down with the apoplexy.
He turned casually to the fat little patriarch.
Your Grace, he said mildly, when you're planning a surprise attack, you usually want to divert your enemy's attention. Doesn't that sort of make sense?
Well, Imban said a bit dubiously,
at least that's the way I'd do it, and Martell's had a great deal of training. I sort of suspect that what's going to happen is that Martell's going to wait until he gets those mangoes built.
Mangonels, Preceptor Abriel corrected.
Whatever, Comyr shrugged. Then he's going to start bashing down our walls. Then he's going to attack the walls with every man he can muster. Believe me, Your Grace, the men on the walls, or what's left of the walls, are going to be very, very busy. That's when Martell's going to come into the cellar, and we're not going to have any men to spare to meet him.
Why do you have to be so blasted clever, Comier? Emben snapped.
What do we do, then? Dolmant asked them.
We don't have any choice, Your Grace, Vanion replied. We're going to have to collapse that aqueduct so that Martell can't get through.
But if you do that, we won't have any report of the meeting between Annius and Martell,
Emben protested shrilly.
Try to look at the whole picture, Emben, Dolmant said patiently. Do we really want Martell voting when we elect a new archprelate?
Chapter 14. They're ceremonial troops, Your Grace, Vanion objected. This isn't a parade or a formal changing of the guard. The four of them, Vanion, Dolmant, Sparhawk, and Sifrania, were gathered in Cernoshan's study.
I've seen them training in the courtyard outside their barracks, Vanion, Dolmant said patiently. I still remember enough of my own training to recognize professionals when I see them.
How many of them are there, Your Grace? Sparhawk asked.
300,
the Patriarch replied.
As the Archprelate's personal guard, they're wholly committed to the defense of the Basilica.
Dolmant leaned back in his chair, tapping his fingertips together.
I don't see that we have much choice, Vanion, he said.
His lean, ascetic face seemed almost to glow in the candlelight.
Emben was right, you know. All our scrambling for votes has gone out the window now. My brothers in the hierocracy are very attached to their houses.
He made a sour face.
It's one of the few forms of vanity left for members of the higher clergy. We all wear plain cassocks, so we can't show off our clothing. We don't marry, so we can't show off our wives. We're committed to peace, so we can't demonstrate our prowess on the battlefield. All that's left for us are our palaces. We lost at least 20 votes when we pulled back to the walls of the inner city and abandoned the palaces of my brothers to Martell's looters. We absolutely must have some evidence of the collusion between Annius and Martell. If we can do that, we turn it around. The burning of the palaces becomes Annius' fault instead of ours.
He looked at Sophrenia then.
I'm going to have to ask you to do something, little mother, he said.
Of course, Dolmant.
She smiled at him fondly.
I can't even ask you officially, he said with a rueful smile, because it has to do with things I'm not supposed to believe in anymore.
Ask me as a former Pandion, dear one, she suggested. That way we can both ignore the fact that you've fallen in with evil companions.
Thank you, he said dryly. Is there some way you can collapse that aqueduct without actually being in the cellar?
I can take care of that, Your Grace, Sparhawk offered. I can use Belium.
No, actually you can't, Sophrenia reminded him. You don't have both rings.
She looked back at Dolmant.
I can do what you ask, she told him, but Sparhawk will have to be in the cellar. I can channel the spell through him.
Better and better, actually, Dolmant said. Vanion, see what you think of this. You and I talk with Colonel Delada, the commander of the Archprelate's guard. We put his guardsmen in the cellar under the command of somebody reliable.
Hurek? Sparhawk suggested.
The very man, Dolmant approved.
I suspect that I'd still obey automatically if Hurek barked an order at me. Dolmant paused.
Why didn't you ever knight him, Vanion?
Because of his class prejudices, Dolmant. Vanion laughed. Curic believes that knights are frivolous, empty-headed men. Sometimes I almost think he's right.
All right, then, Dolmant continued. We put Curic and the guardsmen in the cellar to wait for Martell, well out of sight, of course. What's likely to be the first sign that Martell's main assault on our walls is starting?
Boulders dropping out of the sky, I'd say, wouldn't you, Sparhawk?
That'll be the sign that his mangonels are in place. He won't start his attack until he's sure that they are working properly.
And that would be the most probable time for him to start through the aqueduct, wouldn't it?
Vanion nodded.
There'd be too much chance of them being discovered if they crept into the cellar any sooner.
This is fitting together even more tightly.
Dolmant seemed pleased with himself on that score.
We have Sparhawk and Colonel Delada wait on the walls for the first boulders. When they start crashing down, the two of them go down to the cellar to eavesdrop on the conversation between Martell and Annius. If the arch-prelate's guard can't hold the entrance to the aqueduct, Sophronia will collapse the tunnel. We block the secret attack, get the evidence against Annius, and we may very well capture Annius and Martell themselves. What do you think, Vanion?
It's an excellent plan, Your Grace, Vanion said with a straight face.
Sparhawk also saw a number of gaps. The years seem to have clouded Dolmant's strategic sense in a few areas.
I can only see one drawback, Vanion added.
Oh?
Once those engines batter down the walls, we're likely to have hordes of mercenaries here in the inner city with us.
That would be a bit inconvenient, wouldn't it? Dolmant conceded with a slight frown. Let's go talk with Colonel DeLada anyway. I'm sure something will turn up.
Vanion sighed and followed the Patriarch of Deimos from the room.
Was he always like that? Sparhawk asked Sophronia.
Who?
Dolmant. I think he's pushing optimism about as far as it can be pushed.
It's your Eline theology, dear one, she smiled. Dolmant's professionally committed to the notion of providence. Styrix look upon that as the worst form of fatalism. What's troubling you, dear one?
A perfectly good logical construction has fallen apart on me, Sophronia. Now that we know about Perrain, I don't have any way at all to connect that shadow with Azash.
Why are you so obsessed with hard evidence, Sparhawk?
I beg your pardon?
Just because you can't logically prove a connection, you're ready to discard the whole idea. Your reasoning was fairly tenuous to begin with, anyway. About all you were really doing was trying to distort things to make your logic fit your feelings, a sort of a justification for a leap of faith. You felt, you believed, that the shadow came from Azash. That's good enough for me. I'm more comfortable with the notion of trusting your feelings than your logic, anyway.
Be nice, he chided.
She smiled.
I think it's time to discard logic and start relying on those leaps of faith, Sparhawk. Sir Perrain's confession erases any connection between that shadow you keep seeing and the attempts on your life, doesn't it?
I'm afraid so, he admitted. And to make matters even worse, I haven't even seen the shadow lately.
Just because you haven't seen it doesn't mean it's not still there. Tell me exactly what you felt each time you saw it.
There was a chill, he replied, and an overpowering sense that whatever it was hated me. I've been hated before, Sophronia, but not like that. It was inhuman.
All right, we can rely on that, then. It's something supernatural. Anything else?
I was afraid of it. He admitted it flatly.
You? I didn't think you knew what the word meant.
I know all right.
She thought about it, her tiny, perfect face creased with thought.
Your original theory was really quite shaky, Sparhawk, she told him. Would it really make much sense for Azash to have some brigand kill you, and then have to chase down the brigand in order to retrieve Belliom from him?
It's a little cumbersome and roundabout, I suppose.
Exactly. Let's look at the possibility of pure coincidence.
I'm not supposed to do that, little mother. Providence, you understand.
Stop that.
Yes, Mom.
Suppose that Martell subverted Perrain on his own, without consulting with Annius. That's assuming that it's Annius who's the one dealing with Otha and not Martell.
I don't really think Martell would go so far as to have personal dealings with Otha.
I wouldn't be too sure, Sparhawk. But let's assume that killing you was Martell's idea and not Otha's, or some involuted scheme Azash came up with. That would cover the hole in your logic. The shadow could still be related to Azash and have absolutely no connection whatsoever with the attempts on your life.
What's it doing, then?
Watching, most likely. Azash wants to know where you are, and he definitely wants to know where Belliom is. That might explain why you almost always see that shadow when you remove the jewel from the pouch.
This is starting to make my head ache, little mother. But if everything goes the way Dolmant's planned it, we'll have both Martell and Annius in custody before long. We ought to be able to get a few answers out of them, enough to clear up my headache anyway.
Colonel de Lada, commander of the archprelate's personal guard, was a stocky, solidly built man with short-cut reddish hair and a lined face. Despite his largely ceremonial position, he carried himself like a warrior. He wore the burnished breastplate, round embossed shield, and traditional short sword of his unit. His knee-length cape was crimson, and his visorless helmet had a horsehair crest.
"Are they really that big, Sir Sparhawk?"
he asked as the two of them looked out at the smoking ruins from the flat roof of a house abutting the inner city wall.
"I really don't know, Colonel de Lada," Sparhawk replied. "I've never seen one either. Xavier has, though, and he tells me that they're at least as big as a fair-sized house.
And they can really throw rocks the size of oxen.
That's what they tell me.
What's the world coming to?"
"They call it progress, my friend," Sparhawk said wryly.
"The world would be a better place if we hanged all the scientists and engineers, Sir Sparhawk."
"And the lawyers, too."
"Oh, yes, definitely the lawyers. Everybody wants to hang all the lawyers."
Delada's eyes narrowed.
"Why are all of you being so secretive around me, Sparhawk?" he demanded irritably.
In Delada's case, all the clichés about red-haired people seemed to apply.
"We have to protect your strict neutrality, Delada.
You're going to see something, and we hope hear something, that's very important.
Later on, you're going to be called on to give testimony about it. There are going to be people who'll try very hard to throw doubts on your testimony."
"They'd better not," the colonel said hotly.
Sparhawk smiled. "Anyway, if you don't know anything at all in advance about what you're going to see and hear, nobody will be able to raise any question at all about your impartiality."
"I'm not stupid, Sparhawk, and I have got eyes. This has to do with the election, hasn't it?"
"Just about everything in Kairalos has to do with the election right now, Delada, except maybe that siege out there.
And I wouldn't wager any significant amounts of money that the siege isn't involved, too."
"That's one of those areas we aren't supposed to talk about, Colonel."
"Aha!" Delada said triumphantly. "Just as I thought."
Sparhawk looked out over the wall. The important thing was to be able to prove, beyond doubt, the collusion between Martell and Annius. Sparhawk was a bit apprehensive about that. If the conversation between the Primate of Cimera and the renegade Pandion did not reveal Martell's identity, all Delada would be able to report to the Hierocracy would be a highly suspicious conversation between Annius and an unnamed stranger. Emban, Dolmant, and Ortzel, however, had been adamant. Delada was absolutely not to be supplied with any information that could contaminate his testimony. Sparhawk was particularly disappointed in Patriarch Emban on that score. The fat churchman was devious and deceitful on every other count. Why should he suddenly become ethical on this one crucial point?
"It's starting, Sparhawk," Calden called from the torchlit wall. "The Rendors are coming out to clear away our obstructions."
The rooftop was slightly higher than the wall, and Sparhawk could clearly see over the fortification. The Rendors came rushing out, howling as before. Heedless of the poison smeared on the stakes of the hedgehogs, they rolled the obstructions out of the way. Many, caught up in a frenzied religious ecstasy, even went so far as to throw themselves needlessly on the poisoned stakes. Broad avenues were soon cleared away, and the assault towers began to trundle out of the still-smoking city, moving slowly toward the walls. The assault towers, Sparhawk saw, were constructed of thick planks covered by green cowhides that had been dipped in water so many times that rivulets actually ran from them. No crossbow bolt or javelin would be able to penetrate the planks, and burning pitch and naphtha would not be able to set fire to the dripping hides. One by one, Martell was countering all their defenses.
"Do you actually anticipate fighting in the Basilica, Sir Sparhawk?"
Delada asked. "We can hope not, Colonel," Sparhawk replied. "It's best to be ready, though. I really appreciate your deploying those guardsmen of yours down in that cellar, particularly since I can't tell you why we need them there. We'd have had to pull men off the walls otherwise."
"I have to assume you know what you're doing, Sparhawk," the colonel said ruefully. "Putting the whole detachment under the command of your squire sort of upset my second in command, though."
It was a tactical decision, Colonel. That cellar's full of echoes. Your men won't be able to understand shouted commands. Kurek and I have been together for a long time, and we've worked out ways to deal with situations like that one. Delada looked out at the assault towers lumbering across the open space in front of the walls.
Big, aren't they? He said. How many men can you crowd into one of those things?
That depends on how fond of the men you are, Sparhawk told him, moving his shield in front of his body to ward off the arrows that had already begun to drop onto the roof. Several hundred, at least.
I'm not familiar with siege tactics, Delada admitted. What happens now?
They roll up to the walls and try to charge the defenders. The defenders try to push the towers over. It's very confusing and very noisy, and a lot of people get hurt.
When do those mangonels come into play?
Probably when several of the towers are firmly in place against the walls.
Won't they be dropping boulders on their own men?
The men in the towers aren't very important. A lot of them are Rendors, like the ones out there who got killed clearing away the obstructions. The man who's in charge of that army isn't exactly what you'd call a humanitarian.
Do you know him?
Oh, yes. Very well.
And you want to kill him, don't you?
Delada asked shrewdly. The thoughts crossed my mind a few times. One of the towers was now quite close to the wall, and the defenders, trying to dodge the hail of arrows and crossbow bolts, threw grappling hooks on long ropes over the roof of the lumbering structure. Then they began to pull on the ropes. The tower swayed, rocked back and forth, and finally toppled with a resounding crash. The men inside began to scream, some in pain and some in terror. They knew what came next. The fall of the tower had broken the planks, and the tower lay open like a shattered egg. The cauldrons of pitch and naphtha poured down upon the wreckage and the struggling men, and the torches set the boiling liquid on fire. Delada swallowed hard as the despairing screams of the burning men came shockingly up from the base of the wall.
Does that happen very often? He asked in a sick voice.
We hope so, Sparhawk said bleakly. Every one of them we kill outside the walls is one less who gets inside.
Sparhawk wove a quick spell and spoke to Sophrenia, who was waiting inside the chapter house.
We're just about ready to engage out here, little mother, he reported. Any hints of Martell yet?
Nothing, dear one. Her voice seemed almost to whisper in his ear. Be very careful, Sparhawk. Afriel will be very cross with you if you allow yourself to be killed.
Tell her she's welcome to lend a hand if she'd like.
Sparhawk!
The tone was half shocked and half amused.
To whom were you speaking, Sir Sparhawk?
Delada's voice was baffled, and he was looking around to see if anyone was near them.
You're relatively devout, aren't you, Colonel? Sparhawk asked him.
I'm a son of the Church, Sparhawk.
It might upset you if I told you then. The militant orders have permission to go beyond what's allowed to ordinary members of the Aline faith. Why don't we just let it go at that?
Despite the best efforts of the defenders, several towers reached the wall, and the drawbridges at their tops swung down onto the battlements. One of the towers touched the wall just beside the gate, and Sparhawk's friends were ready for it. Tinian led their charge as they dashed across the drawbridge and into the tower itself. Sparhawk held his breath as his friends struggled inside the tower out of his sight. The sounds from within bespoke the ferocity of the fight. There was the crash of arms and screams and groans. Then Tinian and Calton came back out, ran across the thick-planked drawbridge, and seized a large bubbling cauldron of boiling pitch and naphtha in their steel-clad arms. They lurched back across the drawbridge with it, and disappeared inside again. The screams from within suddenly intensified as they dumped the pitch down into the faces of the men on the ladders inside the tower. The knights emerged from the tower. When Calton reached the wall, he took up a torch and flipped it into the structure with a negligent-appearing toss. The tower acted much like a chimney. Black smoke billowed from the gaping doorway the drawbridge had covered, and then dark orange flame boiled out through the roof. The screaming inside the tower increased, and then it died out.
The counterattacks of the knights along the walls were sufficient to ward off the first wave of attackers, but the defense of the battlements had cost many lives. The sheets of arrows and the heavier bolts from the crossbows had raked the tops of the walls in a virtual storm, and many of the church soldiers and not a few of the knights had fallen prey to them.
"They'll come again?" De Lada asked somberly.
"Of course," Sparhawk said shortly. "The siege engines will pound the walls for a time now, and then more towers will come across that open area."
"How long can we hold out?"
"Four, maybe five of those attacks. Then the mangonels will start to break down the walls. The fighting will start inside the city at that point."
"We can't possibly win, can we, Sparhawk?"
"Probably not."
"Kyrillos is doomed, then?"
"Kyrillos was doomed the moment those two armies appeared, De Lada. The strategy behind the attack on the city was very thorough. You might say almost brilliant."
"That's a peculiar attitude under these circumstances, Sparhawk.
It's called professionalism. One's supposed to admire the genius of one's opponent. It's a pose, of course, but it helps to build a certain abstraction. Last stands are very gloomy, and you need something to keep your spirits up."
Then Bayret clambered up through the trapdoor of the roof upon which Sparhawk and De Lada stood. The novice's eyes were wide, seemingly slightly unfocused, and his head was jerking.
"Sir Sparhawk!"
he exclaimed, his voice unnecessarily loud.
"Yes, Bayret?"
"What did you say?"
Sparhawk looked at him more closely.
"What's the matter, Bayret?" he asked.
"I'm sorry, Sir Sparhawk, I can't hear you. They rang the bells in the basilica when the attack started. All the bells are up in the cupola on top of the dome. You never heard so much noise."
Bayret reached up and thumped the heel of his hand against the side of his head.
Sparhawk took him by the shoulders and looked directly into his face.
"What's happening?" he bellowed, exaggeratedly mouthing the words.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Sir Sparhawk, the bell sort of rattled me. There are thousands of torches coming across the meadows on the other side of the River Aruk. I thought you ought to know."
"Reinforcements?" De Lada said hopefully.
"I'm sure they are," Sparhawk replied. "But for which army?"
There was a heavy, booming crash behind them, and a fair-sized house collapsed in on itself as a huge boulder caved in its roof.
"God!" De Lada exclaimed. "That boulder was enormous! These walls will never withstand that kind of pounding!"
"No," Sparhawk agreed. "It's time for us to go to the cellar, Colonel."
"They started throwing those big rocks earlier than you thought, Sparhawk," the Colonel noted. "That's sort of a good sign, wouldn't you say?"
"I'm afraid I don't quite follow that."
"Wouldn't that suggest that the army to the west is a relief column for us?"
"The troops outside our walls are mercenaries, Colonel. They could be in a hurry to get through our walls so that they won't have to share the loot with their friends out there on the other side of the river."
The lowest cellars of the basilica were constructed of gigantic stones that had been laboriously chiseled and then carefully laid in long, low barrel vaults, supported here and there by massive buttresses. The weight of the entire structure towering above rested entirely upon those mighty arches. It was dim and cool and quite damp in these cellars, lying even below the crypt where the bones of long-dead churchmen moldered in dark silence.
"Churik!"
Sparhawk hissed to his squire as he and De Lada passed the barred gate of an area set off from the rest of the cellar, where Sparhawk's squire and De Lada's guardsmen waited. Churik came to the bars on quiet feet.
"The mangonels have started," Sparhawk told him, "and there's a big army coming in from the west."
"You're just full of good news, aren't you, my lord?"
Churik paused.
"This isn't really a very nice place in here, Sparhawk. There are chains and manacles hanging from the walls, and there's a place toward the back that would have warmed Bellina's heart."
Sparhawk looked briefly at De Lada. De Lada coughed.
"It's no longer used," he said shortly. "There was a time when the church would go to any length to stamp out heresy. Interrogations were conducted down here and confessions obtained. It wasn't one of the brighter chapters in the history of our Holy Mother."
"Some stories about that have leaked out."
Sparhawk nodded.
"Wait here with the guardsmen, Curic.
The colonel and I have to go get into place before either of our visitors arrive. When I whistle for the attack, don't wait around, because I'll really need you at that point. Have I ever let you down, Sparhawk? No, as a matter of fact, you haven't. Sorry I even mentioned it. He led the colonel deeper into the labyrinthine cellar. We're going to go into a fairly large room, Colonel, he explained. There are all sorts of nooks and crannies along the walls. The young fellow who found the place brought me down here and showed it to me. He tells me that the two men we're interested in are likely to meet there. You'll be able to identify at least one of them. Hopefully their conversation will identify the other. Pay very close attention to what they say, please. As soon as the conversation's over, I want you to go directly back to your quarters and lock your door. Don't open it for anybody but me, Lord Vanion, or Patriarch Emban. If it makes you feel better, for a brief period of time, you'll be the most important man in Kyrelos, and we'll set whole armies to protecting you. This is all very mysterious, Sparhawk. It has to be for right now, my friend. I hope that when you hear the conversation, you'll understand why. Here's the door. Sparhawk carefully pushed the rotting door open, and the two of them entered a large dark chamber festooned with cobwebs. A rough table and two chairs sat near the door, and the thick stub of a single candle sat on a cracked saucer in the center of the table. Sparhawk led the way to the rear of the chamber and back into a deep alcove. "Take off your helmet," he whispered, "and wrap your cloak around your breastplate. We don't want any chance of reflection to warn anybody that we're here." Delada nodded. "I'm going to blow out our candle now," Sparhawk told him, "and we'll have to be absolutely quiet. If we need to talk, we'll have to whisper very softly into each other's ears." He blew out the candle, bent and laid it on the floor. They waited. Somewhere far off in the darkness, water was dripping slowly. No matter how tight any drain may seem, there is always seepage, and water like smoke will always find the place it is seeking. It might have been 5 minutes, or an hour, or even a century, when a muffled clinking came from the very far end of the vast cellar. "Soldiers," Sparhawk breathed to Delada. "Let's hope the man leading them doesn't bring them all inside this place." "Indeed," Delada breathed back. Then, a dark-robed and hooded man slipped through the doorway, shielding a single candle with one hand. He lighted the candle on the table, blew out his own, and threw back his hood. "I should have known," Delada whispered to Sparhawk. "It's the Primate of Simera." "It is indeed, my friend. It is indeed." The soldiers came nearer. They were making some effort to muffle the clinking of their equipment, but soldiers as a group have never been much good at stealth. "This is far enough," a familiar voice commanded. "Draw back a ways. I'll call if I need you." There was a pause, and then Martell entered. He was carrying his helmet, and his white hair shone in the light of the single guttering candle on the table in front of the primate. "Well, Aeneas," he drawled, "we made a good try, but the game's played out." "What are you talking about, Martell?" Aeneas snapped. "Everything's going our way." "It changed direction on us about an hour ago." "Stop trying to be cryptic, Martell. Tell me what's happening." "There's an army marching in from the west, Aeneas."
"That other wave of Camorrian mercenaries you told me about?"
"I rather suspect that those mercenaries have been ground into dog meat by now, Aeneas." Martell unbuckled his sword belt. "Hate to break it to you this way, old boy, but that's Worgen's army marching in from the west. They stretch out as far as the eye can reach." Sparhawk's heart leaped with exultation.
"Worgen!" Aeneas cried. "You said you'd taken care of keeping him away from Kyrelos."
"Thought I had, old boy, but somehow someone got through to him."
"His army's even bigger than yours?"
Martell sank wearily into his chair.
"God, I'm tired," he confessed. "I haven't slept for 2 days.
You were saying?"
"Has Worgen got more men than you have?"
"Lord, yes.
He could chew me up in the space of a few hours. I really don't think we ought to wait for him. All I have to worry about is how long it's going to take Sparhawk to kill me. In spite of that face of his, Sparhawk's a gentle person. I'm sure he'd make quick work of me. I'm really disappointed in Perrain. I thought he might be able to do something permanent about my former brother. Oh, well. Idra pays the penalty for his failure, I suppose. As I was saying, Sparhawk should be able to do for me in well under a minute. He's a much better swordsman than I am. You, however, have much more to be concerned about. Lycaeus tells me that Alana wants your head on a plate. I once caught a glimpse of her face in Simera just after her father died and before you poisoned her. Sparhawk's gentle, but Alana's made of stone, and she hates you, Aeneas. She might very well decide to take your head off all by herself. She's a slender girl, and it might take her half a day to hack through your neck.
But we're so close, Aeneas protested in anguished frustration. The arch-prelate's throne is almost within my grasp.
You'd better ungrasp it, then. It might be very heavy to carry when you're running for your life. Arissa and Lycaeus are in my pavilion packing a few things already, but you're not going to have that kind of time, I'm afraid. You'll be leaving from here, with me. Get one thing very clear, Aeneas. I won't wait for you, not ever. If you start to fall behind, I'll leave you.
There are things I have to have, Martell.
I'm sure there are. I can think of a few right offhand myself. Your head, for one. And Lycaeus says that the blonde ape who runs with Sparhawk has developed an unwholesome passion for hanging people. I know Colton well enough to realize how clumsy he is. He's almost certain to botch the job, and being the guest of honor at a botched hanging isn't my idea of a pleasant way to pass an afternoon.
How many men did you bring here into the cellar?
Aeneas' voice was fearful. About 100 is all.
Are you mad? We're right in the middle of an encampment of church knights.
Your cowardice is starting to show, Aeneas. Martell's voice was thick with contempt. That aqueduct isn't very wide. Would you really want to have to clamber over the top of 1,000 well-armed mercenaries when the time comes to start running?
Run? Where can we run to? Where can we possibly go?
Where else? We go to Zamok. Otha will protect us. Colonel de Lada drew in his breath with a sharp hiss.
Be still, man,
Sparhawk muttered. Martell rose to his feet and began to pace up and down, his face ruddy in the candlelight. Try to follow me on this, Aeneas, he said. You gave Elana Daristim, and Daristim's always fatal. There's no cure. And ordinary magic could not have reversed the effects. I know that, because I was trained in magic by Sophrania myself.
That steric witch,
Aeneas said from between clenched teeth.
Martell seized him by the front of his robe and half-lifted him from his chair.
Be very careful what you say, Aeneas, Martell said from between his teeth. Don't insult my little mother, or you'll wish that it was Sparhawk who caught you. As I said, he's basically a gentle sort of person. I'm not. I can do things to you Sparhawk would never dream of.
Surely you don't still have any feeling for her.
That's my business, Aeneas. All right, then. If only magic could have cured the queen and ordinary magic wouldn't have worked, what does that leave us?
Belium?
Aeneas guessed, rubbing his hand over the wrinkles Martell's fist had gathered up in the front of his robe. Precisely. Sparhawk somehow managed to get his hands on it. He used it to cure Elana, and more than likely he's still got it with him. It's not the sort of thing you leave lying around. I'll send the Rendors out to knock down the bridges over the Aruk. That should delay Worgen for a while and give you and me more time to run. We'd better go north for a ways and get out of the main battle zone before we turn east toward Zamok. He grinned mirthlessly. Worgen's always wanted to exterminate the Rendors anyway. If I send them out to destroy the bridges, he'll get his chance.
and God knows I won't miss them all that much. I'll order the rest of my troops to make a stand against Worgen on the east bank of the river. They'll engage him in a splendid battle, which might even last for a couple of hours before he butchers the lot of them. That's about all the time you and I and our friends are going to have to get clear of this place. We can count on Sparhawk to be right behind us, and we can be absolutely sure that he'll have Belium with him.
How do we know that? You're guessing, Martell.
Do you mean to say that you've been around Sparhawk for all these years and haven't gotten to know him yet? I'm not trying to be insulting, old boy, but you're an absolute idiot. Do you know that? Otha's massed in eastern Lamarkan, and he'll be marching into western Aosia within a matter of days. He'll slaughter everything in sight, men, women, children, cattle, dogs, wild animals, even fish. Preventing that is the primary duty of the Church Knights and Sparhawks, what they had in mind when they founded the Four Orders. He's all duty and honor and implacable resolve. I'd give my soul to be a man like Sparhawk. He's got the one thing in his possession that will absolutely stop Otha cold. Do you really think there's anything in the world that would prevent him from bringing Belium with him? Use your head, Aeneas.
What good's it going to do us to run if we know that Sparhawk's right behind us with Belium in his hands? He'll obliterate Otha and us along with him.
Not very likely. Sparhawk's moderately stupendous, but he's not a god. Azash, however, is. And Azash has wanted Belium since before the beginning of time. Sparhawk will chase us, and Azash will be waiting for him. Azash will destroy him in order to take Belium from him. Then Otha will invade. Since we'll have done such a tremendous service for him, he'll reward us, lavishly. He'll put you on the Archprelate's throne and give me the crown of any Alanian kingdom I choose, perhaps even all of them. Otha's lost his hunger for power in the last 1,000 years or so. I'll even set Lycaeus up as regent, or even king of Alania, if you want, although I can't for the life of me think of any reason you'd want that. Your son's a sniveling cretin, and the sight of him turns my stomach.
Why don't you have him strangled,
and then you and Orisa can try again? If you both concentrate, you might even be able to produce a real human being instead of a dung beetle. Sparhawk felt a sudden chill. He looked around. Though he could not see it, he knew that the shadowy watcher that had followed him from Gwerig's cave was somewhere here in the room. Could it possibly be that merely the mention of Belium's name was enough to summon it?
"But how do we know that Sparhawk will be able to follow us?"
Aeneas was asking.
"He doesn't know about our arrangement with Otha, so he won't have the faintest idea of where we're going."
"You are naive, aren't you, Aeneas?" Martell laughed. "Sephrania can listen in on a conversation from at least 5 miles away, and she can arrange to have everyone in the room with her hear it as well. Not only that, there are hundreds of places in this cellar that are within earshot of this room. Believe me, Aeneas, one way or another, Sparhawk's listening to us at this very moment." He paused. "Aren't you Sparhawk?" he added.
Chapter 15. Martell's question hung in the misty dimness.
"Stay here," Sparhawk whispered bleakly to Delada. He reached for his sword.
"Not very likely," the colonel replied, his tone just as grim.
He also drew his sword. It was really neither the time nor the place for arguments.
"All right, but be careful. I'll take Martell. You grab Aeneas."
The two of them stepped out of their place of concealment and walked toward the single candle guttering on the table.
"Why, if it isn't my dear brother Sparhawk," Martell drawled. "So awfully good to see you again, old boy. Look quickly, Martell. You aren't going to be seeing much of anything for very long. I'd love to oblige you, Sparhawk, but I'm afraid we'll have to postpone it again. Pressing business, you understand."
Martell took Aeneas by the shoulder and pushed him toward the door.
"Move," he snapped.
The two of them went quickly out as Sparhawk and DeLada rushed forward, swords in hand. "Stop!" Sparhawk snapped to his companion.
"They're getting away, Sparhawk!"
DeLada objected.
"They already have."
Sparhawk said it with a hot disappointment souring his mouth.
"Martell's got 100 men out there in those corridors. We need you alive, Colonel."
Sparhawk whistled shrilly, even as he heard the rush of many feet in the corridor outside.
"We'll have to defend the door until Keurig and the guardsmen get here."
The two of them went quickly to the rotting door and took their places, one on either side of it. At the last moment, Sparhawk stepped out into plain view a few feet back from the arched opening in the massive stone wall. His position gave his sword full play, but the soldiers rushing through the entrance were hampered in their swings by the rocks of the sides and top of the archway. Martell's mercenaries discovered very quickly what a bad idea it was to rush up on Sparhawk when he was angry. And Sparhawk was very angry at that point. The bodies piled up in the doorway as he savagely vented his rage on the scruffy-looking soldiers. Then Keurig was there with DeLada's guardsmen, and Martell's men fell back, defending the passageway leading toward the opening of the aqueduct, into which Martell and Annius had already fled.
"Are you all right?"
the squire asked quickly, looking in through the doorway.
"Yes,"
Sparhawk replied. Then he reached out and caught DeLada's arm as the colonel started to push past him.
"Let me go, Sparhawk,"
DeLada said from between tight lips.
"No, Colonel. Do you remember what I told you a while ago about your being the most important man in Kyrillos for a while?"
"Yes."
DeLada's tone was sullen. "That particular eminence started just a few minutes ago, and I'm not going to let you get yourself killed just because you're feeling pugnacious at the moment. I'll take you to your quarters now, and post a guard outside your door." DeLada rammed his sword back into its sheath.
"You're right, of course," he said.
"It's just that..."
"I know, DeLada. I feel the same way myself." After he had seen to the colonel's safety, Sparhawk returned to the cellar. The guardsmen under Keurig's command were in the process of mopping up and flushing out any mercenaries who were trying to hide. Keurig came back through the torchlit darkness.
"I'm afraid Martell and Annius got completely away, Sparhawk," he reported.
"He was ready for us, Keurig," Sparhawk said glumly. "Somehow he knew we'd either be down here or that Sophrenia could work a spell so that we could hear him. He was saying a lot of things for my benefit."
"Oh?"
"The army coming in from the west is Worgen's."
"It's about time he got here."
Keurig suddenly grinned. "Martell also announced which way he's going. He wants us to follow him."
"I'll be overjoyed to oblige him. Did we get what we want, though?"
Sparhawk nodded. "When DeLada's done with his report, Annius won't get a single vote." "That's something, anyway. Put some captain in charge of these guardsmen and let's go find Vanion." The preceptors of the four orders were standing atop the walls near the gates, looking with some puzzlement out at the now retreating mercenaries.
"They just broke off the attack for no reason," Vanion said as Sparhawk and Keurig joined them.
"They had reason, right enough," Sparhawk replied. "That's Worgen over there across the river."
"Thank God," Vanion exclaimed. "Word must have reached him after all. How did things go in the cellar?"
"Colonel DeLada heard a very interesting conversation. Martell and Annius got away, though. They're going to make a run for Zaymok to seek Otha's protection. Martell's going to send his Rendors out to destroy the bridges to give the rest of his mercenaries time to deploy. He doesn't have much hopes that they'll be able to do much more than inconvenience, Worgen. All he's really hoping for is enough delay to give him time to get away."
"I think we'd better go talk with Dolmant," Preceptor Darylon said. "The situation has changed a bit. Why don't you round up your friends, Sir Sparhawk, and we'll go back to the chapter house?"
"Pass the word, Keurig," Sparhawk told his squire. "Let all our friends know that King Worgen's come to our rescue." Keurig nodded. The patriarchs were enormously relieved to hear of King Worgen's approach, and even more relieved to hear that Annius had incriminated himself. "The colonel can even testify about the arrangement Annius and Martell have with Otha," Sparhawk told them.
The only unfortunate part of the whole business was that Annius and Martell escaped.
How long will it take for word of this turn of events to reach Otha?
Patriarch Emban asked.
I think we'll almost have to assume that Otha will know about the change in the situation here almost as soon as it happens, Your Grace, Preceptor Abriel told him.
Emban nodded with a look of distaste.
More of that magic business, I suppose.
It's going to take Worgen quite some time to regroup and start to march into Lamarkan to meet the Zamox, isn't it? Dolmant said.
A week or 10 days, Your Grace, Banyan agreed. And even that's cutting it a little fine. Advance elements from both armies will be able to move out more rapidly, but neither main force will be able to start in less than a week.
How far can an army move in a day? Emban asked.
10 miles maximum, Your Grace, Banyan replied.
That's absurd, Banyan. Even I can walk 10 miles in 4 hours, and I don't move very fast.
That's when you're walking alone, Your Grace. Banyan smiled.
A man out for a stroll doesn't have to worry about keeping the rear of a column from straggling, and when the time comes to sleep for the night, he can roll himself in his cloak under a bush. It takes quite a bit longer to set up an encampment for an army.
Emban grunted, laboriously hauled himself to his feet, and waddled to the map of Eosia hanging on the wall of Sir Nashan's study. He measured off some distances.
They'll meet about here, then, he said, stabbing one finger at a spot on the map, on that plain to the north of Lake Camoria.
Ortsel, what's the country like around there?
Relatively flat, the Lamarck Patriarch replied. It's mostly farmland with a few patches of woods here and there.
Emban, Dolmant said gently, why don't we let King Worgen work out the strategy? We have our own business to attend to, you know.
Emban laughed a bit sheepishly.
I guess I'm a born busybody, he said. I can't stand to let anything go by without sticking my nose into it.
He clasped his hands reflectively behind his back. We'll have everything under control here in Kyrelos just as soon as Worgen gets here. I think it's safe to say that Colonel de Lada's testimony will eliminate the candidacy of the Primate of Simara once and for all. So why don't we clear away this election business right away, before the hierocracy has time to gather its collective breath? Patriarchs are political animals, and as soon as they've had the time to collect their wits, they're going to start to see all sorts of opportunities in the present situation. We don't really need a number of unanticipated candidacies clouding things over right now. Let's keep it simple if we can.
Not only that. We alienated a fair number of patriarchs when we decided to let the outer city burn. Let's catch the hierocracy while it's still overwhelmed with thanksgiving and gratitude and fill that empty chair in the basilica before they start brooding about lost houses and the like. We've got the upper hand for the moment. Let's use it before our support starts to crumble.
That's all you ever really think about, isn't it, Emban? Dolmant said.
Somebody has to, my friend.
We'd better get Worgen into the city first, though, Banyan told them. Is there anything we can do to help him?
We can move out of the inner city just as soon as Martell's generals start turning around to face his army, Comier suggested. We can hit them from behind and sting them enough to force them to chase us back inside the walls. Then they'll have to divert enough troops to keep us penned up in here. That should reduce the force facing Worgen a little bit.
What I'd really like to do is figure out some way to defend those bridges across the Aruk, Abriel said.
Replacing them is what's going to cost Worgen time and lives.
I don't see that there's very much we can do about that, Darylon said. We don't have enough men to keep the Rendors away from the riverbank.
We have got enough to disrupt things inside the city, though, Gomir asserted. Why don't we go back to the wall and size things up a bit? I need something to do to take the taste of that siege out of my mouth anyway.
There was fog as dawn approached, for the summer was drawing to a close, and the two rivers that joined at Kyrelos fumed gray, wispy tendrils of mist from their dark surfaces in the cool of the night. And the tendrils joined together to form first a haze that softened the orange torchlight, then a mist that enshrouded distant houses. And finally, that thick, clinging fog is common in cities that are built along rivers. There was enthusiasm in the ranks for the action. There were tactical reasons for the plan, of course, but tactics are for generals,
and the common soldiery was more interested in revenge. They had endured the pounding of siege engines, they had beaten off fanatics climbing scaling ladders, and they had faced the assault towers. Until now, they had been forced to bear whatever the besiegers had hurled at them. This was their chance to even some scores, to chastise their chastisers, and they marched forth from the inner city with looks of grim anticipation on their faces. Many of Martell's mercenaries had joined him with enthusiasm when there had been the prospect of loot and rapine and easy assaults on meagerly defended walls. Their enthusiasm waned, however, at the notion of meeting a vastly superior force in open country. They became peace-loving men at that point and crept through the foggy streets in search of places where their newly found pacifist sentiments would not be offended. The sortie in force from the inner city came as a great surprise, and an even greater disappointment to men bent merely upon leading simple lives untainted by strife. The fog, of course, helped enormously. The defenders of the inner city had only to fall upon men who were not wearing the armor of church knights or the red tunics of church soldiers. The torches these sudden pacifists carried made them easy targets for Keurig's now proficient crossbowmen. Since men on horseback make too much noise, the church knights moved through the streets on foot. After a time, Sparhawk joined Vanion. "All we're doing here is picking off deserters," he advised his preceptor. "Not entirely, Sparhawk," Vanion disagreed. "The church soldiers have been under siege, and that sort of thing wears down men's spirits. Let's give our questionable allies the chance for a little revenge before we turn them back over to the patriarchs." Sparhawk nodded his agreement, and then he, Colton, and Keurig moved out to take the lead. A shadowy figure carrying an axe appeared at a torch-lit intersection. The outline showed that whoever it was wore neither armor nor the tunic of a church soldier. Keurig raised his crossbow and took aim. At the last instant, he jerked his weapon upward and the bolt whizzed up toward the pre-dawn sky. Keurig started to swear sulphurously. "What's the matter?" Colton hissed. "That's Bayret," Keurig said from between clenched teeth. "He always rolls his shoulders that way when he walks." "Sir Sparhawk," the novice called into the darkness. "Are you down there?" "Yes." "Thank God! I think I've walked down every burned-out alley in Kyrillos looking for you." Keurig banged one fist against a wall. "Talk to him about it later," Sparhawk said. "All right, Bayret," he called. "You've found me. What's important enough for you to go around risking your skin to try to share it?" Bayret came down the street to join them. "The Rendors appear to be gathering near the west gate, Sir Sparhawk. There are thousands of them." "What are they doing?" "I think they're praying. They're having some kind of ceremony at any rate. There's a skinny, bearded fellow standing on a pile of rubble haranguing them." "Could you hear any of what he was saying?" "Not very much, Sir Sparhawk, but he did say one word fairly often, and all the rest bellowed out the word each time he said it." "What was the word?" Keurig demanded. "Ramshorn, I think it was, Keurig." "That's got a familiar ring to it, Sparhawk," Keurig said. Sparhawk nodded. "It appears that Martell brought Ulysses along to keep the Rendors in line." Bayret gave him a puzzled look. "Who's Ulysses, Sir Sparhawk?" "The current spiritual leader of the Rendors. There's a twisted piece of a sheep's horn that's a kind of badge of office." He thought of something. "The Rendors are just sitting around listening to sermons?" he asked the novice. "If that's what you want to call all that babbling, yes." "Why don't we go back and talk with Vanion?" Sparhawk suggested. "This might be very useful." The preceptors and Sparhawk's friends were not far behind. "I think we've just had a bit of luck, my lords," Sparhawk reported. "Bayret's been out wandering around in the streets. He says that the Rendors are all gathered near the west gate and that their leader's whipping them into a frenzy." "You actually let a novice go out there alone, Sir Sparhawk?" Abriel asked disapprovingly. "Keurig's going to talk to him about that later, my lord." "What was this leader's name again?" Vanion asked thoughtfully. "Ulysses, my lord. I've met him. He's a total idiot."
What would the Randors do if something happened to him?
They'd disintegrate, my lord. Martell said that he was going to order them to tear down the bridges. Apparently they haven't started yet. Randors need a lot of encouragement, and some rather careful directions before they start on anything. Anyway, they look upon their religious leader as a semi-divinity. They won't do anything without his express command.
That might just be the way to save your bridges, Abriel, Vanion said. If something happens to this Ulysim, the Randors may just forget what they're supposed to do. Why don't we gather up our forces and go pay them a call?
Bad idea, Keurig said shortly. Sorry, Lord Vanion, but it really is. If we march on the Randors in force, they'll fight to the death to defend their holy man. All we'll do is get a lot of men needlessly killed.
Do you have an alternative?
Keurig patted his crossbow.
Yes, my lord, he said confidently.
Beirut says that Ulysses making a speech to his people. A man who's talking to a crowd usually stands up on something. If I can get to within 200 paces of him...
Keurig left it hanging.
Sparhawk, Vanion decided. Take your friends and protect Keurig. Try to slip through the city until you can get him and that crossbow close enough to this Ulysses to remove him. If those Renderish fanatics fly all to pieces and don't destroy the bridges, Worgen will be able to cross the river before the other mercenaries are ready for him. Mercenaries are the most practical soldiers in the world. They're not very enthusiastic about hopeless battles.
You think they'll capitulate? Darylon asked.
It's worth a try, Vanion said. A peaceful solution of some kind here could save us a lot of men on both sides. And I think we're going to need every man we can lay our hands on, even the Randors, when we come up against Otha.
Abriel suddenly laughed.
I wonder how God's going to feel about having his church defended by Ashandist heretics.
God's tolerant, Comier grinned. He might even forgive them, a little.
The four knights, Beirut and Keurig, crept through the streets of Kyrelos toward the west gate. A faint breeze had come up, and the fog was rapidly dissipating. They reached a large, burned-out area near the west gate to find thousands of tightly packed and heavily armed Rendors gathered in the thinning mist about a heaped-up pile of rubble. Atop the rubble stood a familiar figure.
"That's him, all right," Sparhawk whispered to his companions, as they took refuge in the gutted remains of a house. "There he stands in all his glory. Ulysses. Most favored disciple of Holy Arashim."
"What was that?" Calden asked.
"That's what he called himself down in Rendor. It was a self-bestowed title. I guess he wanted to spare Arashim the effort of selecting somebody.
Ulysses was in a state bordering on hysteria, and his speech had little in the way of coherence to recommend it. He held one bony arm aloft, and he was tightly clutching something. After about every 15 words, he would shake the object in his hand vigorously and bellow, "Ram's horn!" His followers then would roar back, "Ram's horn!"
"What do you think, Keurig?" Sparhawk whispered as they all looked over a half-collapsed wall.
"I think he's crazy."
"Of course he's crazy, but is he in range?"
Keurig squinted across the top of the crowd at the ranting fanatic.
"It's a goodly way," he said dubiously.
"Give it a try anyway," Calden said. "If your bolt falls short or even goes over, somebody of Renderish persuasion's bound to catch it for you."
Keurig laid his crossbow across the top of the broken wall to steady it, and took careful aim.
"God has revealed it to me," Ulysses was shrieking to his followers. "We must destroy the bridges that are the work of the Evil One. The forces of darkness beyond the river will assault you, but Ram's Horn will protect you. The power of the Blessed Ashand has joined with that of Holy Arashim to fill the talisman with unearthly might. Ram's Horn will give you victory."
Keurig squeezed the lever of his crossbow slowly. The thick bow made a deep-toned twang as it sped the bolt toward its mark.
"You are invincible!" Ulysses was shrieking. "You are..."
Whatever else it was that they were never revealed.
The veins of a crossbow bolt were suddenly protruding from Ulysses' forehead just above his eyebrows. He stiffened, his eyes wide and his mouth suddenly gaping. Then he crumpled into a heap atop the rubble.
"Good shot!" Tinian congratulated Curic.
"Actually, I was trying to hit him in the belly," Curic confessed.
"That's all right, Curic,"
the Deiran laughed. "It was more spectacular this way, anyhow." A vast groan of shock and dismay ran through the crowd of Rendors. Then the word crossbow raced through the crowd. A number of unfortunates had obtained such weapons from the Lamarks in one way or another. They were torn to pieces on the spot by their frenzied compatriots. A fair number of the black-robed men from the south ran off through the streets, howling and tearing at their garments. Others slumped to the ground, weeping in despair. Still others stood staring in stunned disbelief at the place where Ulysses had only recently stood haranguing them. There was also, Sparhawk noticed, a fair amount of on-the-spot politics going on. There were those in the crowd who felt that they had a claim on the recently vacated position, and they began to take steps to ensure their elevation to eminence, reasoning that power rests more securely in the hands of sole survivors. Adherents of this or that candidate joined in, and the huge crowd was soon embroiled in what could only be called a general riot. "Political discussion is quite spirited among the Rendors, isn't it?" Tinian observed mildly.
"I noticed that," Sparhawk agreed. "Let's go tell the preceptors about Ulysses' accident." Since the Rendors were now militantly indifferent to bridges, sheep's horns, or the impending battle, the commanders of Martell's army saw that they had no chance whatsoever against the human sea on the far side of the river. Mercenaries are the most realistic of all soldiers, and soon a sizable detachment of officers rode across one of the bridges under a flag of truce. They returned just before daybreak. The mercenary commanders conferred for a few moments, and then they formed up and, pushing the rioting Rendors ahead of them, marched out of Kyrelos and laid down their arms in surrender. Sparhawk and the others gathered atop the wall of the outer city, right beside the open west gate, as the kings of western Aeosia rode quite formally across the bridge to enter the holy city. King Worgen, flanked by the mail-shirted patriarch Bergston, King Dragos of Arsham, King Soros of Pelosia, and the ancient King Obler of Deira, rode at the head of the column. Directly behind them came an ornate open carriage. Four people sat in the carriage. They were all robed and hooded, but the sheer bulk of one of them sent a chill through Sparhawk. Surely they wouldn't have... And then apparently at some command from the slightest of them, the four pushed back their hoods. The fat one was Platamie. Stragon was the second. The third was a woman whom Sparhawk did not recognize. And the fourth, slender and blonde and looking altogether lovely, was Alana, Queen of Elenia. Chapter 16. Worgen's entry into Kyrelos was hardly triumphant. The commoners of the Holy City had not been in a position to stay abreast of current affairs, and one army looks very much like another to ordinary people. For the most part, they stayed under cover as the kings of Aeosia passed on their way to the Basilica. Sparhawk had little chance to speak with his queen when they all arrived at the Basilica. He had things to say to her, of course, but they were not the sort of things he wanted to say in public. King Worgen gave his generals a few abrupt commands, and then they followed the Patriarch of Deimos inside for one of the get-togethers that normally mark such occasions. "I'll have to admit that this Martell of yours is very clever," the King of Thalesia conceded a bit later, leaning back in a chair with an ale tankard in his hand. They had gathered in a large, ornate meeting room in the Basilica. The room had a long, polished table, a marble floor, and thick burgundy drapes at the windows. The kings were present, as were the preceptors of the four orders, Patriarchs Dolmant, Emban, Ortsel, and Bergston, and Sparhawk and the others, including Uleth, who still exhibited moments of vagueness but appeared to be on the mend. Sparhawk's face was stony as he looked across the table at his bride-to-be. He had many things he wanted to say to Elana, and a few he was saving up for Platamie and Stragon as well. He was controlling his temper with some difficulty.
"After the burning of Coombe," Worgen went on, "Martell took a weakly defended castle perched on top of a crag. He strengthened the defenses, left a sizable garrison there, and then moved on to lay siege to Larium. When we came up behind him, he fled east. Then he swung south, and finally he went west again toward Coombe. I spent weeks chasing him. It seemed that he'd led his whole army into that castle, and I settled down to starve him out. What I didn't know was that he'd been detaching whole regiments from his army to hide in the countryside as he marched. And so he reached that castle with no more than a very small force. He sent that force inside the walls and closed the gates, and then he rode away, leaving me to besiege an impregnable castle and leaving him free to regather his forces and march on Kyrillos.
"We sent a great many messages to you, Your Majesty," Patriarch Dolman said.
"I'm sure you did, Your Grace," Worgen said sourly. "But only one of them reached me. Martell cluttered most of Arsham with small bands of ambushers. I expect that most of your messengers are lying in ditches down there in God's own rock garden."
"Sorry, Dragos," he apologized to the Arshan king.
"That's all right, Worgen," King Dragos forgave him. "God had a reason for putting so much rock in Arsham. Paving roads and building walls and castles gives my people something to do other than starting wars with each other."
"If there were ambushes out, how did anybody manage to reach you, Your Majesty?" Dolmant asked.
"That was the strange part of it, Dolmant," Worgen replied, scratching at his tousled head. "I never really did get the straight of it. The fellow who got through is from Lamarkand, and it appears that he just rode openly all the way across Arsham and no one paid any attention to him. Either he's the luckiest man alive, or God loves him more than most. And he doesn't look all that lovable to me."
"Is he nearby, Your Majesty?" Sophrania asked the King of Thalesia, her eyes strangely intent.
"I think so, little lady," Worgen belched. "He said something about wanting to make a report to the Patriarch of Kadok. He's probably out there in the hall somewhere."
"Do you suppose we might ask him a few questions?"
"Is it really important, Sophrania?" Dolmant asked her.
"Yes, Your Grace," she replied. "I think it might be. There's something I'd like to verify."
"You," Worgen said sharply to one of the soldiers standing at the door. "See if you can find that seedy-looking Lamarck who's been trailing after us. Tell him to come in here."
"At once, Your Majesty."
"Naturally at once. I gave an order, didn't I? All my orders are obeyed at once."
King Worgen was already on his fourth tankard of ale, and his grip on civility was beginning to slip.
"Anyway," he went on, "the fellow arrived at that castle I was besieging no more than 2 weeks ago. After I read his message, I gathered up the army, and we all came here."
The Lamarck who was escorted into the room was, as Worgen had said, a bit on the seedy-looking side. He was obviously neither a warrior nor a churchman. He had thin, lank, dun-colored hair and a big nose.
"Ah, Ek,"
Patriarch Ortsel said, recognizing one of his servants. "I should have guessed that you'd have been the one to make it through. My friends, this is one of my servants, Ek by name. A very sneaky fellow, I've found. He's most useful when stealth is required."
"I don't think stealth had much to do with it this time, Your Grace," Ek admitted.
He had a nasal sort of voice that seemed to go with his face.
"As soon as we saw your signal, we all rode off to the west as fast as our horses could run. We started to run into ambushes before we even reached the Arshan border, though. That's when we decided to split up. We thought that one of us, at least, might get through. Personally, I didn't have much hope of that. There seemed to be a man with a longbow behind every tree. Anyway, I hid out in a ruined castle near Dara to think things over. I couldn't see any way to get your message through at all. I didn't know where King Worgen was, and I didn't dare ask any travelers for fear that they were some of the men who'd been killing my friends."
"Perilous situation," Darylon said.
"I thought so myself, my lord," Ek agreed. "I hid in that ruin for 2 days, and then one morning I heard the strangest sound. It seemed to be music of some kind. I thought it might be a shepherd, but it turned out to be a little girl with a few goats. She was making the music on those pipes that herders carry. The little girl seemed to be about 6 or so, and I knew as soon as I saw her that she was Styric."
End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.